Welcome to today's deep dive. It is Thursday, April 30th, 2026. And today we are tackling a really fascinating paradox. Basically, the United States spends roughly $450 million a year to keep a fleet of just over 70 internationally trading ships flying the American flag.
Yeah, which is a tiny footprint.
Right, a microscopic slice of global shipping.
Yeah.
We pay this massive premium to keep these vessels nominally ours. But then you look at a country like Greece. They do not hand out those kinds of massive direct government stipends, right?
Right.
Yet Greek interests control something like 17% of the entire global commercial fleet.
It's a huge disconnect. I mean, the sheer amount of American capital poured into this sector versus the physical fleet we actually have to show for it, it's staggering.
It really is. So our mission today is to figure out why the U.S. essentially bankrupts itself trying to maintain this tiny fleet while peer nations are just thriving. We're pulling from this incredible internal research paper from CAMP.
Right, the Center for American Energy and Maritime Policy.
Exactly. Authored by Captain R.S. Phillips. And the cover of this report alone really sets the scene for you. It has the CAEMP logo right in the middle, this circular emblem featuring a U.S. map wrapped in the American flag. And it's surrounded by a cargo ship, wind turbines, and an offshore rig.
It perfectly captures the scope of what is at stake here: energy, trade, national identity. The data in this paper basically proves that the U.S. is fighting a 21st century economic war using, 20th century tools.
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to break down this U.S. maritime cost paradox, what European nations do differently, and this potential multi-million dollar tax fix.
Yep.
But before we get into why the U.S. fleet is struggling, we need to establish what it actually means to have a fleet.
Because the terminology is a total trap.
Exactly. It's full of traps. The core concept is separating beneficial ownership from the flagged fleet. The way I interpret it is kind of like buying a high-end luxury car and living in New York, but registering it in Montana to avoid taxes.
Right, the classic Montana LLC loophole.
Right. The car belongs to a New Yorker. You profit from it, you drive it, but legally, the vehicle is governed by Montana.
And that mechanism happens on a massive scale globally. A ship might be beneficially owned by an entity in one country, managed in another, crewed by citizens of a third, but it flies the flag of a completely different sovereign nation.
So the flag dictates the rules.
Exactly. Which tax laws, safety standards, labor regulations apply, all of that comes from the flag on the stern. You brought up Greece earlier. Greek interests beneficially own nearly 395 million deadweight tons of shipping.
Wow.
Yeah, they are the undisputed largest ship-owning nation on the planet. But 87% of that tonnage is registered under foreign flags.
Wait, 87%. So if you're just counting ships flying the Greek flag, you're missing basically their entire actual economic footprint.
Almost 90% of it, yeah. It's a fundamental analytical error to just count flags. We always have to separate who owns the asset from whose legal jurisdiction it operates under.
And we also need to clarify how we measure these things, right? Gross tonnage versus deadweight tonnage.
Right, that's another trap. Gross tonnage, or GT, is just internal volume, enclosed space. But operational capacity is deadweight tonnage, DWT, the actual weight of cargo, fuel, and crew it can carry.
So comparing the two is like comparing apples to bowling balls.
Exactly. And a lot of tax law hinges on volume rather than cargo weight, which radically alters the math.
Okay, got it. And for the listener, we also have to distinguish between the international and domestic fleets. The international fleet competes on the open ocean, but the U.S. domestic fleet is governed by the Jones Act.
Right. The Jones Act mandates that cargo moved between two U.S. ports must be on U.S.-flagged, built, owned, and crewed ships.
It's a legally closed monopoly. No foreign competition.
None. But the international market is a ruthless open market. You have open registries, places like Panama or Liberia, competing purely by offering zero corporate taxes, minimal regulations, and zero physical presence requirements for the owners.
So how do traditional nations fight back against that?
Well, they created second registers. It is an intermediate framework. The ship keeps the national flag and the high safety standards, but the government allows the owner to hire foreign crews at international wages.
Just to slash operating costs.
Sure.
So if a commercial operator can flag in Liberia, pay no corporate tax, and pay cheap international labor rates, choosing the U.S. flag is basically financial suicide.
It really is. The only logical way a U.S.-flagged international fleet exists is if the government directly pays for it.
Which brings us to the Maritime Security Program, the MSP. The U.S. government relies on this as a retainer agreement, right?
Right. They pay a flat stipend to the operators of 60 commercially viable, militarily useful ships. In exchange, those operators legally bind themselves to make those ships, the American crews, and their global logistics networks available to the Department of Defense instantly in a war or emergency.
And the cost for this is wild. For fiscal years 2025 and 2026, the stipend is $6.5 million per ship per year.
It adds up fast.
Yeah, you add the 60 MSP ships plus the 10 vessels in the tanker security program, which gets $6 million each. So the taxpayer is spending about $450 million annually just to keep 70 ships commercially viable.
To be fair, the military rationale is sound. The Pentagon gets guaranteed access to a global logistics network for $450 million. If they had to purchase, maintain, and crew 70 modern cargo ships themselves to sit in reserve, the capital expenditure would be in the tens of billions.
Okay, the military logic works. But the economic logic, it creates a subsidized ceiling. The fleet size isn't determined by market demand. It's capped by the congressional budget.
Exactly.
That's like a nightclub with a strict VIP list. Congress hands out exactly 60 wristbands. If you want to flag a 61st vessel, you get no subsidy. You just absorb the massive operating costs yourself.
And that cost gap is insurmountable. The CAEMP report pulls from MARAD 2011 baseline data. U.S. ships cost roughly 2.7 times more to operate than comparable foreign flagships. But the real lethal blow is the crew costs.
Right, employing U.S. citizen mariners.
It costs 5.3 times more than hiring foreign crews. For a U.S. ship, crew costs are 68% of total operating expenses. For a foreign competitor, it's just 35%.
Wait, okay, U.S. citizens working abroad usually get the foreign earned income exclusion. They can exclude over $100,000 from federal taxes. Why can't mariners just use that to offset these costs?
It's a total geographical irony in the tax code. Under federal tax law, a U.S. flagship is considered U.S. territory. A mariner could be sailing through the Strait of Malacca halfway across the globe, but legally, the IRS considers them to be on American soil.
Oh, wow. So they fail the foreign earned requirement immediately.
Instantly. And even if Congress tweaked that, there's a 330-day physical presence test. Yeah. You have to be physically present in a foreign country for 330 full days in a 12-month period, because mariners operate on rotations, like 4 months at sea, 2 months home. Nobody hits 330 days anyway.
So the tax code actively forces U.S. labor costs higher, and then the government writes a $450 million check to cover the gap it just created.
That's the paradox. So we have to look at how nations like Denmark and Norway keep massive fleets without writing blank checks.
Yeah, how do they do it?
In the late 80s, their fleets were bleeding out to open registries, so they built second registers. Denmark built the DIS, Norway built the NIS. They kept their flags and safety standards, but permitted foreign crews at international wages.
Neutralizing that 5.3x crew cost gap instantly. But labor is only half the ledger. What about the corporate tax burden?
This is how European maritime dominance was secured. They implemented the tonnage tax. Instead of taxing corporate profit at 20 or 25%, the government levies a tiny fixed tax based on the volume of the vessel.
The gross tonnage.
Exactly. It effectively drops the corporate tax rate on international shipping income to near zero.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The CAEMP report highlights Germany as this ultimate cautionary tale of how to completely botch a tonnage tax.
It's a massive unforced error.
Because if you offer a near zero corporate tax rate, you have to link that benefit to your sovereign flag. And Germany didn't do that.
No, they didn't. They only required the ships to be commercially managed from Germany. They secured the corporate presence, but lost the sovereign asset. Owners took the massive tax break while continuing to flag their vessels in Panama and Liberia.
The audit numbers on this are crazy. From 2021 to 2024, German ship owners saved an estimated 22.5 billion euros in taxes. They kept their ownership base, but the German flagged fleet collapsed by roughly 70%.
A 22 billion euro subsidy to gut their own fleet. Contrast that with Denmark, which link theirs to the flag, and they retain over 25 million deadweight tons today.
So where does this leave the U.S.? We can't really do a second register because U.S. maritime labor unions fiercely oppose allowing foreign crews.
Right. They view it as the destruction of the American merchant marine. It's politically a non-starter. So the CAEMP report proposes tackling the crew cost gap from a different angle, a seafarer income tax exclusion.
Basically, a bespoke tax exclusion just for mariners. Exclude their wages on U.S. flagged ships from federal income tax. The workers' net take-home pay jumps massively, but the shipping corporation doesn't have to increase the gross wage.
Exactly. The report's core scenario models, covering about 12,000 active mariners at an average $120,000 wage with a 12% effective tax rate, it would cost the U.S. Treasury about $173 million a year.
Which is way less than the $450 million we spend artificially propping up the 70 ships right now.
Yeah.
But we run into the classic economic problem of tax incidents.
Right. Who actually benefits?
Yeah, if the government makes this tax-free, who gets the money? If I'm a massive shipping corporation and I know my deck officers are suddenly paying zero federal income tax, my instinct is to cut their gross pay and pocket that $173 million for my shareholders.
It's the critical variable, the timeline of tax incidents. In the short run, years 0 to 2, the mariners keep it. The labor force is highly unionized, meaning wage stickiness prevents owners from just tearing up contracts. Plus, there's a severe labor shortage. MARA estimated a deficit of over 1,800 credentialed mariners.
So owners have zero leverage to dictate pay cuts right now.
None. But in the medium run, years 2 to 5, that shifts. The higher net pay attracts new academy grads. The labor pool expands, the deficit eases, and owners regain leverage. They might not cut nominal gross wages, but they'll slow the growth rate of future contracts.
And long run.
The report models two paths. Path A assumes the fleet size stays the same. Owners capture a significant portion of the tax savings. Economic theory suggests they might pass those savings to consumers via lower freight rates.
Okay, I have to push back on Path A, especially regarding the protected domestic Jones Act market.
I know exactly where you're going with this.
It's a closed loop. Zero foreign competition allowed to Hawaii, Alaska, or Puerto Rico. In a monopoly, do consumers actually see any of these freight savings, or do the ship owners just pocket the difference?
It's a very fair point, and the report acknowledges it. In monopolistic lanes, cost savings rarely reach the consumer. The problem is the U.S. government doesn't collect lane-level freight rate pass-through data to prove it either way.
Which means Path B is the only acceptable outcome, the growth scenario.
Right. Under Path B, the tax exclusion lowers operating expenses enough that flagging a new vessel in the U.S. becomes commercially profitable. If the fleet expands, owners need multiple new crew rotations for every new ship. That sustained labor demand prevents the pool from saturating. Mariners keep their leverage, the fleet grows, and the military gets larger sea lift capacity without expanding MSP stipends.
But a tax exclusion alone is just a band-aid. The report explicitly warns that to mimic the success of peer nations, we need a cohesive architecture. Five pillars, right?
Yes. We touched on Pillar 1, registry reform, the controversial second register concept. Pillar 2 is tonnage tax modernization.
Wait, the U.S. already has a tonnage tax, doesn't it?
We do under Subchapter R, but it's almost useless. It requires a 6,000 deadweight ton minimum, excluding smaller vessels, and it excludes the domestic Jones Act fleet entirely. We need to lower that threshold, include domestic ships, and enforce flag linkage to avoid Germany's mistake.
Got it. Pillar 3 is administrative modernization, moving from paper to electronic certificates. How much does paper actually hurt these operators?
Immensely. Paper means physical inspectors have to travel to board the vessel. If a ship is sitting idle at a berth waiting for a physical stamp, it's burning tens of thousands of dollars a day without moving cargo. 45 other flag administrations already use electronic certificates.
That friction translates directly to lost revenue. Okay, Pillar 4, the skills compact. If owners get a massive tax break, they need to guarantee a return on investment for the labor pool, like the UK's smart scheme.
What?
Yes. The UK co-funds maritime training with a £43 million package. But the key is the mandate. If a company gets the tonnage tax benefit, they must train one cadet for every 15 officers.
It prevents them from extracting value today while starving the labor pool of tomorrow.
Exactly. And Pillar 5 is repositioning the MSP.
Using that $390 million program as a pure defense readiness retainer rather than an artificial life support system for commercial viability.
If Pillars 1 through 4 are implemented, these vessels can compete commercially on their own. The MSP just secures guaranteed military access.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Basically, the global supply chain and our national security depend on a math equation that the U.S. is currently losing. The current approach gives us a defense-critical nucleus, but absolutely no room to grow.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, there's an external threat that could render this entire conversation moot.
The OECD.
Yes. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development introduced BEPS 2.0, specifically Pillar 2. It aims for a 15% global minimum corporate tax rate.
And if a multinational corporation pays less than 15% anywhere, their home country can tax them up to that floor.
Right. Now, currently, international shipping has a carve-out from that 15% floor. That single loophole is keeping every European tonnage tax regime alive.
Because a tonnage tax pushes the effective corporate rate to near zero? So if that loophole closes,
every tonnage tax regime globally instantly becomes illegal. The effective tax rate on global shipping jumps to 15% overnight, entirely rewriting the rules of global maritime trade. The tools keeping European fleets afloat against open registries would just evaporate.
That is wild. The survival of the global supply chain rests on tax codes and international loopholes most people don't even know exist. You see a cargo ship and think of steel and diesel, but the actual force keeping it afloat is an invisible web of statutory definitions and sovereign subsidies, something for you to keep a very close eye on. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
We will catch you on the next one.